James S. Ellison, Charles A. Town Council, Robert A. Sampson, III, Senior Assistant Attorney General, Appellate Council.
You may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Charles Hayden, and I represent Clinton Arthur Jr., who was convicted in a jury trial in the Norfolk Circuit Court of one count of possession of a firearm by a person convicted of a violent felony. He was sentenced to 5 years in prison. In this case, the trial court was asked to engage in a balancing test in Rule 2-403, and here it's readily apparent the trial court failed to apply Rule 2-403's balancing test correctly. The defense counsel noted that the case of Old Chief and how that would seem to apply here, there was a proffer made of or willingness to stipulate the fact of the violent conviction of a violent felony, and the
why would Old Chief apply?
Well, certainly that Old Chief applied the federal rule 403, the federal analog to Virginia rule 403, and that case would seem to suggest that the old case of Glover and its progeny of Essex no longer apply.
But when the General Assembly codified our rules of evidence, they made very clear that it was not meant to change our laws, and it certainly was not meant to wholesale adopt the federal system.
Well, when they adopted the state rules of evidence in 2012, they adopted Rule 2-403 that requires a balancing test to be done.
But my point is they did not adopt federal interpretations. Old Chief was a 5-4 opinion. It split the court right down the middle. The opening line of the dissent, or the closing line of the dissent, is that the court, the majority, manufactured a new rule that didn't previously exist. Their words, not mine. And you're telling us that we have to adopt that splintered opinion and call it Virginia law? We have no choice to make our own judgment?
Well, I would respectfully submit that we clearly have adopted the what amounts to the Virginia analog of the federal
rule. Right, so, I mean, is your argument that it's persuasive, or is your argument that it's binding? I mean, so if the Alabama Supreme Court or Alaska Supreme Court construes identical rule, I'm going to say, oh, well, I buy that. I think that's wise. Or I completely disagree, but we're not bound by that, are we?
Right. But the trial court is bound by Rule 2-403 that requires a balancing test to be done. And even she failed to apply a balancing test. She ruled on page 23 of the Court of Appeals appendix. She said,
can I stop you just for a second? Because I guess the question I have, which I think both Justice Kelsey and Justice McCullough asked, are you claiming that Old Chief is binding on a Virginia court?
I'm not saying that I think it is, but even if we set aside the fact that certainly in interpreting the rule, the U.S. Supreme Court has interpreted this rule that where's an alternative available that does not carry the unfair prejudice, the balancing test requires the court to exclude the alternative that does run the risk of unfair prejudice to the defendant. I submit that the logic there certainly applies to the logic here. It ought to be followed. But even if it's not, there's still the rule, our rule, Virginia's rule, requires a balancing test to be performed. And she patently failed to apply it here, the trial court. She said, I cannot require, I don't believe I'm authorized to require the Commonwealth to accept. That's just plainly wrong.
May I interrupt you for a second, Mr. Hayden? Perhaps she said that because the common law of our 403, which preexisted the evidence rules being codified. We've always had a legal prejudice test from the very beginning of evidentiary law. The common law has historically always been that neither side can sanitize the record by stipulating away the things they don't like in the other side's case. And that's been in civil court, it's been in criminal court, and the only thing, as I can tell, you have is a 5-4 opinion that's highly debatable from my personal point of view.
But we do have Rule 20403. She clearly declined to exercise the balancing test. She says, I'm not even authorized to require the Commonwealth to accept it. If the Commonwealth wants to put on the evidence, then he's permitted to do so. And she's saying, I'm not entitled to overrule using 403 to rule that there is unfair prejudice. She is authorized specifically, and the court in the Boone case, the 2013 case where this court noted that, Glover and its progeny may no longer be good law. We don't address that question here, but noted the fact in the footnote. They noted, this court noted, that this Rule 2403 does not give the Commonwealth unfettered license to admit every relevant conviction of a serial criminal. In applying, what's required to be applied is Rule 2:402. And this court noted in Gamosch versus Allen, 268 Virginia 222, in determining whether relevant evidence should be admitted, the circuit court must apply a balancing test to assess the probative value of the evidence and its prejudicial effect. The balancing test requires the probative value be substantially outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice. And this court noted in the 2015 case, Lee versus Spoden, 290 Virginia 235, that it noted the Old Chief case that requires the consideration of whether this evidence presents unfair prejudice.
Counsel, let me ask you this question. The assignment of error is this. Trial court erred in allowing the Commonwealth to introduce Arthur's previous felony conviction, and that Arthur offered to stipulate to that element of the offense. You've devoted your argument to an error in failing to perform the balancing test that the rules of evidence require. How was that encompassed by this assignment of error, which seems to point us in a different direction, which is there's an offer of stipulation, so that's it. Now, you have to accept that, I think, versus, well, here's this evidentiary problem, and you have to undertake the inquiry, and you have to do that balancing, which you didn't do. They seem to be divergent arguments.
Rule 2403 requires the balancing test to be done. Old Chief, applying the federal analog to this rule, too, also requires the balancing test to be performed.
I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just trying to get at. I mean, we have these. What we do is resolve the error that's assigned, and I'm trying to figure out how your entire argument this morning is encompassed by that assignment.
Well, in this case,
it seems like it would take a generous reading of the assignment of error to get at that.
The trial counsel argued Old Chief applies and it overrules the old cases of Glover. And it argued that the Court of Appeals erred in refusing to consider whether Old Chief applied and whether the balancing test required the exclusion of this evidence. And so I'm submitting that both Old Chief and the Rule 2403 require the consideration of whether this creates unfair prejudice.
You actually don't challenge the Court of Appeals ruling in this case either, do you? I mean, I'm not sure how you get past Rule 5:17c on that issue.
Well, I think the assignment of error as it was written did not specifically refer to the Court of Appeals. I think I might have done that differently if I was the person writing. But in the argument of the brief, he's certainly challenging the Court of Appeals' failure to require the trial court to apply Rule 2403 and apply the Old Chief case that is clearly relevant to the consideration of it and certainly on point to this case.
What about the ruling of the Court of Appeals saying that there was a waiver which prevents the defendant from claiming any
prejudice? I think that's just wrong.
I know, you might think it's wrong, but you didn't assign an error to it, though.
801-384, you certainly argued that it should have been considered. 801-384 requires that it says it's sufficient that a party make known to the court the action he desires the court to take or his objections to the action of the court and its grounds, therefore. No party having made an objection known to the court shall be required to make such objection again to preserve his right to appeal a ruling, order, or action of the court. That was done in this case. It does say, but then if you don't ask for a cautionary instruction, the issue is not preserved.
That goes to preservation, and what we're trying to figure out is how we fall within the assigned errors for what you're complaining about to us this morning and what the Court of Appeals did.
In this case, the Court of Appeals said, well, there was not a request for a cautionary instruction, and they said, therefore, we can't even consider it this.
But what the Court of Appeals said was the trial court offered a cautionary instruction, and it was declined. So the harm, if there is any harm at all, it was allowing the evidence in without a cautionary instruction. And that is the gradation of error. And their point was, following Thomas, which was a opinion from the Court of Appeals that went in bank, and it's been the law for a long time, that if that's the scenario, then you've got to say, well, the cautionary instruction would not have been sufficient. But that was never argued. That was never said. In fact, the opposite happened. Cautionary instruction was refused. Yes.
The trial counsel's position was a cautionary instruction would have been insufficient under the circumstances. Court is required to grant a new trial where the prejudicial effect of an improper evidence is overwhelming such that it cannot be cured by a cautionary instruction. And that was the case we had here. It was just like in the Old Chief case. There was a cautionary instruction given there, but that was ruled insufficient to overcome the unfair prejudice created by introducing evidence that this person has committed an offense similar to the thing that he's on trial for today, just like in this case. The defendant offered property. He's been convicted of a violent felony, but instead we bring in evidence here unnecessarily, convicted of robbery, use of a firearm in a case involving a firearm offense, just like suggests he's the kind of person to commit firearm.
So the defendant has a right, in fact, under what you see to be 403 jurisprudence, to sanitize the record whenever they stipulate away the legal issue.
The rule 801-384 doesn't say that if he doesn't request a cautionary instruction, he therefore waives his objection. It doesn't say that.
I'm not
talking
about that.
It just says preserve this, and then if he recognizes that cautionary instruction wouldn't have cured the prejudicial effect, the prejudicial effect was so overwhelming and likely to cause the jurors to rule on improper factors, that cautionary instruction, a curative instruction, would not have cured that, just as in the Old Chief case. It doesn't, though, mean he waives the issue and it can't even be considered on appeal. I respectfully submit 801-384 was complied with. He made known to the court what the ruling was he wanted, and the trial court failed to do it. Simply apply Rule 2403. The court failed to do it. Thank you.
Yeah, minute 44.
Good morning. May it please the court, Robert Anderson. For the Commonwealth, Commonwealth submits that for any of three reasons the court should affirm the judgment of the Court of Appeals. First, the defendant has committed a default on the trial court level by failing to take the trial court up at its offer to give a cautionary instruction. Second, the Court of Appeals essentially made a procedural default ruling saying that the failure to act on that offer barred review of the merits of the claim, And yet the assignment of error, the one assignment of error in this court, has sole reference to the actions of the trial court. Second, on the merits, we submit that the ruling was entirely consistent with many Virginia appellate decisions, both in this court and the Court of Appeals of Virginia, and nothing in Old Chief requires this court to jettison that long line of cases. Third, if there was error, it was harmless because the only real issue in the case is whether the defendant possessed the gun, and the evidence is overwhelming to that effect. Now, taking them in order, the trial court initially held that the Commonwealth did not have to accept the stipulation that the defendant had a prior violent felony conviction, which of course was one of the two elements for this particular charge under 18.2-3082. The trial court made pretty clear that it was basing its decision on the state of Virginia law. Later, and by the way, there was precious little said by the defendant at that time in connection with you're not carrying out a proper balancing test under the Virginia rule. As much more we've offered the stipulation and under Old Chief you should accept it. Later in the trial, the trial court said, well, I've looked at it some more and I'm willing to give a cautionary instruction that would make clear that these convictions are only to satisfy an element of the offense. They don't show that he's more likely to have committed the current crime, in other words, to dispense with any notion of propensity evidence or bad character, etc. And as Judge Frank said in the opinion for the Court of Appeals, essentially the cautionary instruction would have given the defense whatever was necessary on that score. The defense counsel, his total response on the record of that was nothing. The counsel says something today that is simply incorrect. He says that the trial counsel's position was that the cautionary instruction would have proven ineffectual. He may have made noises to that effect in his argument in this court. He didn't say a word in the trial court. He didn't, for example, he didn't say, well, Your Honor, with all respect, your cautionary instruction offer is too little, too late, the train's left the station, whatever. He said nothing. He simply didn't act on the offer, and he offered no explanation or rationale for his decision to do so. The Court of Appeals held that that failure to accept the cautionary instruction was fatal to any review on the merits. In other words, it's in effect a procedural default ruling. And the Court of Appeals said quite correctly that cautionary instructions normally, well, one, like any other instruction, the jury is presumed to follow them, and that cautionary instructions are deemed normally sufficient to alleviate or foreclose any potential prejudice from a bit of evidence. This court's decision in Telugu's death penalty case is a vivid example of that. In that case, two witnesses made references to the defendant's supposed connections to the Russian mafia. Cautionary instruction was given, and this court held quite clearly cautionary instruction was sufficient to rectify any potential prejudice arising from that testimony, which I submit, by the way, is far more problematic on the face of it in terms of potential prejudice to the defendant than the fact that a jury becomes aware that a defendant has prior criminal convictions. I would submit that in this day and age, a jury is hardly likely to be scandalized by proof that the defendant has a prior record. Between that and the Russian mafia, I think that is less potentially damaging or prejudicial on the face of it. And because...
Was Judge Frank's opinion in this case new law, or was it following the precedent of the Court of Appeals?
I certainly think it was of the Court of Appeals, and I think this court as well. You said this was entirely consistent with existing Virginia law. But I qualify that by saying the court made clear that it was not defending, it was not upholding the ruling of the trial court on the merits. We don't get to it because the failure to accept the cautionary instruction, which presumptively would have alleviated any difficulty, showed that the defendant could not show prejudice, which was a necessary showing for relief in order to sustain his argument.
That was the holding of Thomas in 2004.
Right. I'm pretty sure they cited Thomas. I certainly did in my brief. And it makes perfect sense. I mean, if you have a vehicle that this court has repeatedly indicated is normally sufficient to foreclose potential harm from some evidence, then the failure to act on it should have consequences. And as I said on brief, any uncertainty on this point should be resolved against the appellant. The appellant had this procedural avenue available to him, and they chose not to act on it. Then, in effect, he can't properly argue, well, any uncertainty arising out of all of this somehow inures to my benefit.
But the analogy would be a prosecutor's remark during closing arguments that might cross the line a little bit. If there's merely an objection and no request for mistrial and no request for cautionary instruction, it's done.
Right. Even where the objection is overruled, you still, under Virginia law, and you could logically say, what's the point of this? It's already been overruled, but nevertheless, you're required to make a motion for mistrial or seek a cautionary instruction. The other plain default here, again, the Court of Appeals made, in effect, a procedure default ruling. Procedure default ruling is the kind of ruling that only an appellate court can make, such as harmless error. Suppose the Court of Appeals here had said, well, there was error, but under the evidence in this case, the record in this case, it's plainly harmless. Again, that's the kind of ruling only an appellate court could make. And I submit that an appellate, under those circumstances, would be absolutely obligated to specifically assign that ruling of the appellate court, in addition to whatever they have to say about the trial court, and challenge it. And a couple of cases that I cited on brief are very clear-cut examples of that proposition. One case, Williams v. Commonwealth, the Court of Appeals rejected several claims on the ground of procedural default. In this court, the assignments of error solely were on the merits. Didn't say a word about the default rulings, and this court held that the failure to challenge those default rulings barred review on the merits. Also a case, Davis v. Johnson, where there were a number of ineffective counsel claims rejected on multiple grounds, including the rule in Anderson v. Warden, where normally your guilty plea representations serve to bar challenges on habeas if the attorney somehow is ineffective, which is an independent and sufficient ground in and of itself. On appeal, the habeas petitioner challenged the ineffective counsel rulings of the circuit court on other grounds, did not say anything about Anderson v. Warden. Because Anderson v. Warden remained unchallenged and because there was a sufficient basis in and of itself to sustain the rejection of the habeas petition, the merits arguments on the remaining claims went by the boards. So I submit that that is very much the equivalent of what happened here. Counsel today said that the ruling, procedural default ruling of the Court of Appeals was wrong. Well, the time to do that is to assign error and to demonstrate as much. Counsel does say that in the course of this very short brief, there's about a three-sentence reference to the supposed fact that the offer of the trial court would have been an illusory offer, ineffectual. The time to have made that argument was in the trial court, but beyond that, this is said in the context of an assignment of error solely referring to the trial court, and I think the law makes pretty clear you cannot expand the scope of a assignment of error in that manner. I mean, if assignment of error challenged a confession explicitly only on Fifth Amendment grounds, you couldn't, in the course of the argument, say, well, also, there was a Sixth Amendment violation here. And that's effectively what occurred. Now, on the cautionary instruction, and this gets more to the merits, in Old Chief, counsel said that Old Chief ruled that the cautionary instruction given in that case was held inadequate. Well, and I've looked at Old Chief about three times, and unless I missed it, I see absolutely no reference in the 5-4 majority opinion to the fact that cautionary instruction was given. The dissent certainly mentioned that and made arguments much in line with Virginia cases and what I've argued here, which cautionary instruction was given and presumed to alleviate any problems. Now, the very fact that the majority in Old Chief never mentioned a cautionary instruction having been given suggests that the government, for reasons that would seem inexplicable to me, never defended what happened in the court based on the giving of that cautionary instruction. If so, then the value of Old Chief, I think, is substantially undercut in terms of what to do in this case. If, on the other hand, the government did defend the result in Old Chief based on the giving of the cautionary instruction, and the majority, for whatever reason, disregarded it, then I submit that that's a pretty glaring omission and certainly undercuts any notion that it's persuasive authority that this court should follow. And by the way, there's no the only real argument on brief, I think, is plainly wrong, which is that Old Chief obligates this court to overrule a long line of Virginia decisions. The much more reasonable argument is, well, it was based on the federal rules of evidence, not the Constitution, so therefore it's not binding, but on the other hand, it's persuasive, and this court should essentially find it sufficiently persuasive to set aside a long line of Virginia cases.
But even that argument is problematic because the General Assembly made very clear to us by adopting our rules that they did not intend to change the law.
Right.
And yet we had a decade-long pattern of ruling on this very issue.
And I think the Boone case is instructive on somewhat a related ground. Boone is a post-Old Chief decision, which Old Chief, by the way, has been around for about 21 years, so it's not fresh off the presses. And admittedly, one of the ways to distinguish Boone from the present case is that the defendant there never offered a stipulation, and I certainly agree that's a distinguishing factor. But it's still interesting as to the principles of law that this court emphasized in Boone. I mean, it cited a case of the Court of Appeals of Virginia, Pittman v. Commonwealth, in which, among other things, the Court of Appeals acknowledged Commonwealth's prerogative to choose what evidence to offer to meet its burden of proof. And then it said it was, Pittman said the Commonwealth's entitled to utilize its entire arsenal of prior convictions to meet its burden. This court said, we agree. They just didn't simply say, well, this is how it's worked out in the Court of Appeals, expressed affirmative agreement. It also noted that both the statute in Pittman and Section 182-308.2a establish the elements of their respective offenses. Neither provides a rule of evidence constraining the Commonwealth's prerogative to prove those elements with its choice of the available evidence.
Could you briefly address harmless error before you finish?
Yes, sir. There's no question that there are two elements. There's no question that the prior conviction aspect was not an issue. There's no question that there was no error in the penalty phase because there was a fixed result. The only possible issue is the guilt phase. In the guilt phase, I think between the very sparing references to the prior order and the overwhelming proof the defendant possessed the gun, such as his two admissions to the responding police officer, his admission to the EMT who responded, his being shot in the bedroom with his mother when no one else was there, and his mother and his sister calling 911 saying he shot himself, and even in his final statement several weeks later to the police when he was all over the lot, but about three of his statements he effectively admitted he shot himself, which is another way of saying he illegally possessed the gun. So I think the evidence was so overwhelming on that score, coupled with the very sparing references to the conviction, as to render any error harmless. I'd ask the court to affirm. Thank you.
Thank you very much. May I ask the clerk not just put the on the go ahead. Come on up, Mr. Hayden. Don't start the clock yet. Mr. Hayden, I am aware that you have received a number of questions with the pronoun you in it. I'm also aware that you didn't try this case. You didn't appeal it to the Court of Appeals. You didn't argue it in the Court of Appeals. You didn't appeal it to this court, and you didn't even write the opening brief to this court. So I just wanted to set the record straight for everybody who's listening to this argument that the you doesn't mean you, and you're doing the best you can with what's etched in stone. You may proceed.
Thank you. It was suggested that there was not a curative instruction given in the old chief case, but in fact, according to footnote 2 on page 10 of the of old chief decision, in footnote 2, it's noted that the government's the instruction actually given was the district court charged, you have heard the evidence that the defendant has previously been convicted of a felony. You may not consider a prior conviction as evidence of guilt of the crime for which the defendant's now on trial. So there was a curative instruction given in that case. Even so, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that the manifest unfair prejudice was not cured by this curative instruction. And I think although the trial counsel did not state on the record at the trial court why he did not seek a cautionary instruction, I submit that the reason was that it was clear that there was that the curative instruction would not have cured
Mr.
the problem.
Hayden, may I interrupt you for a second? But footnote 2 goes on to say, tell me if I'm reading this incorrectly, while Old Chief's proposed instruction was defective even under law as he viewed it, the instruction actually given was erroneous even on the government's view of the law.
Right.
So the cautionary instruction was fatally flawed as the majority interpreted it. That's not obviously what we're talking about. We're talking about a cautionary instruction that would not be fatally flawed.
Well, I would submit it was suggested there was no curative instruction given. There was a curative instruction. It was a wrong, and it was certainly failed to overcome the prejudice that occurred. There was actually two different version offered by the government, one by the defendant. Neither one was adequate. I see that my time has run out.
Has he finished answering your question, Justice Kelly? All right. The court will be in recess until 10 minutes till 11.
All rise.